Iku Iluna, please rise. O hea o ko e ko ka aha, inahe kuleana I mua o kea aha, ho o kolo kolo ki I ki e, hano hano o ka moku aina o Hawaii. E nao e mai, e malio mai, I lohe I a kaleo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and you shall be heard. E noho I lalo, please be seated.
Please call the case.
Case number SCWC-22-267, State of Hawaii versus Seth Browder, arguing for the petitioner defendant appellant Seth Browder, Walter Julio Rodby, arguing for the respondent plaintiff appellee, State of Hawaii, Stephen K. Tsushima. Argument on the merits.
All right. Good morning. Aloha, everyone. Our proceeding today is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel, as well as on Olelo. I'd like to welcome our two newest members of the court, Justice Lisa Ganoza and Justice Vlad Devins. Today marks the first time the five of us are hearing oral argument together as a court. Counselor, are you ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. We've allocated 30 minutes for each side. Mr. Rodby, you'll begin with 20 minutes. You've asked to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, and Mr. Tsushima will give you a warning with 10 minutes to go. Mr. Rodby, please proceed.
And once again, good morning, Chief Justice Rechtenwald. Good morning, Justice Aloha. McKenna. Good morning. Good morning, Justice Eddins. And maybe I'm a little too close for the microphone, but good morning, Justice. Justice Ganoza and Justice Devins. Good morning. Good morning. So I was appointed in April of 2022 to represent Mr. Browder. Mr. Browder had been convicted in the Third Circuit, the on the Kona side of the island. I accepted the appointment to help him to represent him on this appeal. And so, of course, what did I do? I ordered the transcripts. I spoke to the people involved in the case, and I began the briefing process. That was, of course, once again, back in April of 2022. Then in October 31st, was Halloween that your opinion came out in the Hirata case, Chance Hirata. And there it was. I read the opinion, and I could see that the parties were the same. And what was involved here and what was involved there? There was a trial strategy. There was a script. There was a narrative arc that deliberately and purposefully commented improperly upon victim impact evidence. This is a trial strategy that was utilized to inflame the passion and prejudice of the jury to the point where that strategy could outweigh the strength of legitimate evidence. This trial strategy utilized prejudicial victim impact evidence that is clearly prohibited by this court in State versus Rivera. And what was that comment? This is consistent with one who has been traumatized. It's a comment, it was a pronouncement, it was a point of view, it was an opinion of the prosecution. It was a comment that was made by one who's supposed to be a minister of justice. It's a comment by one who our society holds in the highest regard, a prosecutor in our judicial system. And this is a comment uttered by somebody who's literally sitting on the same side as the jury, literally feet away from the jury. And it's a comment that implies knowledge and information about the case, which was not provided to the jury. And it's a comment also that if you think about it, it mentions trauma. And if we look at the DSM, trauma is actually a psychological diagnosis. It refers to a mental disorder in the Diagnostics and Statistics Manual of Mental Disorders.
Mr. Rodby, is it your point of view that trauma is beyond the ken of an average juror to assess? How so?
Yes, because once again, I don't know if I would say it's a term of art, but it's a diagnosis. It's a mental diagnosis. It's somebody who was upset. The prosecutor said a lot of different things that we didn't object to, but when you use a word like trauma, we would argue that it implies much more than, you know, somebody being upset. It implies a mental disorder. It implies that there's something more that was presented to the jury. At least in Hirata, Chantarata's case, you had an expert who came in as a generic witness. This is how a person in that situation would behave. This is how a person in that situation would act. But in this case, in Mr. Browder's case, there was no expert.
So how could the prosecutor refer to the demeanor of the CW in terms of how she acted in the weeks and days and minutes after the event, as well as the trial?
Yeah, so the prosecutor actually did make comments in closing argument. She made reference to the fact that you saw, and this is the transcript of December 13th, page 92, and this is what she said in closing argument. You saw her testify, ladies and gentlemen. She was shaking. She was crying. She was scared. That is all legitimate, because that was actually presented to the jury. The jury could see, oh yeah, this is a witness that was upset. This is a witness that had tears in her eyes. This is a witness that was behaving like that. But then when you come out and say that somebody was traumatized, I think that's exactly what Hirata prohibited. And I don't understand the ICA's logic in saying that it's okay for that to happen in Hirata, but not in this case.
Well, Hirata involved a child.
Yes.
And there is a lot of, there was evidence in that case about unique ways in which children respond to trauma and how it affects their memory. So
yes.
Isn't that a possible distinction, where in this case it's an adult and it's within the common knowledge of folks how people approach and react to traumatic events?
Yeah, yes, I would agree. But once again, it goes back to the idea, the fact that you have a minister of justice, you have someone who is, you know, I've had cases, Your Honor, where, you know, and it stings right off the bat, it stings, because what happens when the prosecutor stands up in front of the jury and says, oh, you know, my name is blah, blah, blah. I represent the people of Hawaii. I mean, they're held in the highest regard, prosecutors are. My name is, you know, whatever, Mr. Prosecutor, and I work for Mr. Carlisle. Those are powerful words. And I know, Judge Justice, you know, I've listened to some of your oral arguments, and I know you talk about a cold transcript, right? It's hard to see exactly what was happening in the courtroom just by reading words on a page. But in this case, you know, you have the prosecutor who is, you know, once again, held in the highest of esteem, making these types of comments. We can't tell by reading the transcript whether, you know, for example, she was traumatized. And that word rings in the courtroom.
You're saying that a prosecutor can never say that a victim was traumatized?
Unless there is some type of evidence to support that. For example, like in Hirata, where there's an expert.
I thought the concern here was with the way it was phrased, that the prosecutor said all of this emotional crying, scared. This is consistent with someone who's been traumatized. I thought it was the way that it was presented, the consistent with someone who's been traumatized, which suggests some sort of like knowledge or expert opinion that this is how traumatized people appear in court.
Forgive me, I was wrong, and you're right. It's the way that it was phrased, and it's the context of the words there that were
Mr. Rosby,
to the jury. Yes.
Let's talk about the context, because the context of the one sentence in the entire closing argument is that before saying this is consistent with someone who's been traumatized, the prosecutor referred to would you not agree with me? Things that were in evidence, right? The things that they could see when she was, when the complaining witness was testifying. And then things that either she testified to or other witnesses testified to, that she was scared the morning after the incident. She was scared at the hospital later that day. She was scared even a week and a half later, which is, I think, one of the detectives interviewed her a week and a half later after the incident, and she was still scared in court. Those are all things that were in evidence or before the jury that they could see, right?
Yes.
And then the one remark in question occurs. So in context, isn't the deputy referring to the evidence that's in the record?
But once again, she is referring to evidence that's in the record, but it's a comment, it's a personal opinion about the psychological state of the complaining witness.
How I mean, she doesn't refer to it as a diagnosis or as, she didn't utilize it in a scientific way, did she?
Yeah. Well, how could she when there was no expert provided?
Right,
but it is improper victim impact evidence. It's a comment about the status of a witness after the fact.
So you cannot say that a complaining witness has been emotionally affected by an alleged assault.
I think you could say that.
But the one word traumatized is the problem.
That's one of my issues, Judge. That's just one of my issues.
Mr. Robby, you know, in this case, there's a DNA expert. DNA expert testifies that certain things were consistent with certain findings. Are the words consistent with expert speak typically in a trial? When somebody... usually when you hear consistent with, as somebody who's been in the courtroom for a couple decades,
yes,
is that expert speak?
It is. And I don't see how it couldn't be.
And let me ask you this too, with your experience as a defense lawyer, picking juries, trying cases, is it fair to say that jurors have no idea and no experience with how a victim of sexual assault testifies in court?
Yes.
In your experience, is it maybe, maybe not, that evidence of pre-testifying, post-event conduct, whether somebody's emotional or not, sometimes witnesses are emotional, sometimes witnesses are calm. Is that
true?
Right?
Sometimes they're angry. Sometimes, yes.
And just like after an event, when somebody's disclosing, whether it's to parents or whether it's to a campgoer or whether it's to police, whether it's to a detective, is it always that somebody's emotional or is it always that somebody has a more calm effect?
No, of course not.
So when a prosecutor gets up and says that some kind of pre-conduct, they're tethering their remarks to, look, here's a person who cried before, here's a person who was emotional before, and to then say that that's consistent with somebody who's been traumatized, which to me means suggested that this event happened, is that a fair statement?
It's not a fair statement, and it's a statement at exactly the wrong time. Evidence is closed. Witnesses, their testimony is concluded. There is no further evidence before the court. The jury is about to go into the deliberation room and make a decision. And what had they just heard? That, you know, out of nowhere, there is this suddenly, oh, she was traumatized, you know, consistent with, and it's just those. And once again, CJ, I know you talk about cold transcripts, and it's just, I'm not going to say it doesn't reflect it, but there are certain ways that words have so much power. And right before the jury deliberates, that's the wrong time to be saying the wrong thing.
The words have power. Do they have more power when they're coming from a seasoned veteran sex crimes prosecutor who is suggesting that something is consistent with somebody who's been traumatized.
Yes, yes. And you know, if Judge Leonard were here, if she's watching on YouTube, I wanted to thank her, because although I wrote my brief and everything, she lined it up. She lined up how the script in Herata is essentially the same script that was used here.
And that is in the sense that the alleged victim in Herata also had a pretty highly emotional response post-sex assault.
Is that yes, right? Yes.
And that the prosecutor in Herata also, just like in Browder, mentioned those facts before springing the consistent with sex.
It's almost trauma. As if there's a script and then you take the facts of your case and you plug them in. And it's a script that, I gotta say, denies a defendant their right to a fair trial.
Oh, counsel, the jury doesn't know if it's a seasoned prosecutor or not, right? They're just watching this attorney give a closing statement.
Yeah.
And it was closing argument, right? It was argument.
Yes.
And the instruction that was given to the jury was to use reason and common sense to draw inferences. It's
yes.
a standard jury instruction that was given in this case without objection. And it was in that context that the prosecutor seemed to be drawing that inference based on reason and common sense, which we told the jurors, don't leave your common sense outside, bring it into the courtroom with you.
Yes.
And it was in the context of all this evidence that was given about what happened to this complaining witness.
Yes.
She was sexually assaulted. She thought a knife was placed in the to her back. She seemed to have been physically assaulted. She had bruising, other indications of injury.
Mm-hmm.
Why not draw a reason and common sense inference that she was traumatized as an everyday use of that word?
Because it's, once again, it's the wrong thing to say at the wrong time.
What's wrong
with the complaining witness?
What's wrong with the word, though, in that context?
In her direct testimony, she never used the word traumatized. She never said, I was traumatized.
Isn't that the inference, though?
Yeah, it's the
based on reason and common sense, based on the evidence that was presented. And wasn't there somewhat of a cognitive testing done by that nurse? She had training in psychiatry?
No, excuse me?
That's what I read in the record, that nurse Davis.
Yes, Missy
she
Davis.
Had, Missy Davis, she had some background in psychiatry. Wasn't that part of the record?
Yes, but I don't think she ever sat down and conducted a diagnosis of the complaining witness as far as her mental state. She was there to, you know, help her in the emergency room, and that was it. It wasn't as if she checked in regularly for appointments with Missy Davis. But it's just, my point being
let me ask you, and I apologize for interrupting, but was there, since you bring that up, was there anything in the record that indicated any type of medical diagnosis, a psychological diagnosis of someone being traumatized, this victim in this case?
No.
I'm going to get back to my original question.
Yes.
I thought your concern was... Well, so you are indicating a concern with the use of the word traumatized.
And in conjunction with consistent.
I thought the concern was with the way that it was presented. This is consistent with someone who's been traumatized,
yes.
which connotes an expert
yes.
opinion.
Yes.
Let's say that a prosecutor is trying to question the credibility of someone who's on the stand, who was very emotional and dramatic on the stand. Would it be proper for the prosecutor to say this is consistent with a person with histrionic personality disorder?
No, that would not be allowed.
I thought it was the way this was phrased, which it connotes an expert opinion, because traumatized does have lay connotations also.
Mm-hmm.
If the prosecutor had said the victim was, the CW was traumatized, she had physical injury, she was crying, it seems to me that's quite different from saying the manner in which she testified is consistent with someone who's been traumatized. Because as Justice Edens has indicated, what if the CW in this case was completely dispassionate, unemotional? Would the prosecutor then be able to say, because I've presided over sex assault trials where CWs came up and were completely dispassionate and unemotional. Mm-hmm. Would the prosecutor be able to say, you saw how this person testified. She was completely dispassionate, unemotional, and spoke very clearly and calmly. This is consistent with someone who's been traumatized through a sexual assault. Would that be okay for a prosecutor to say?
No, no, Justice.
Can I ask you, is it a two-way street? If in that case, could defense counsel come up and argue, hey, you saw her, she was absolutely flat, affectless, it's not consistent with the way someone who's been traumatized testifies. And this prosecutor stands up and objects. The court then, under your view, should sustain the objection, correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Yes, sir.
Now, is it your approach to, you're suggesting we need expert testimony in order to, in every case, in order to guide the jury through understanding sort of what they're otherwise might be able to use their common sense to interpret, to say, you know, this is how people respond to trauma, and some people are very worked up about it and very emotional, others aren't, and before an argument can be made? Because that's kind of where it seems to be leading.
What I'm trying to say is that a comment like this, an observation, an opinion, is victim impact evidence, and victim impact evidence should not be permitted. And if there's an objection, then it should be stricken.
In other words, there should be some sort of expert evidence on the issue to which the prosecutor or defense attorney can refer.
Exactly. And this court has, you know, for example, in the Rivera case, I believe it was a burglary case where victim impact evidence was presented and utilized in closing arguments, and That kind of evidence can overpower legitimate evidence. That type of opinion can overpower legitimate evidence.
So anything about how someone felt, appeared in their demeanor in the wake, if it's the CW or the victim, that's out of bounds under your point of view?
No, I think if we could have specific examples, that would be better. But for example. Like, for example, there was another Kona case where a security guard was assaulted, and the trial court let in like video of the guy going through physical therapy. I mean, that was not relevant to the accusation. And what other outcome would that have but to inflame the passion and prejudice of the jury against the defendant?
Mr. Rodney,
yes.
Before your time goes up, I think you mentioned earlier that the complaining witness hadn't testified about being traumatized, and in fact, I think she did, right?
On direct. She never used the word trauma. She talked about everything that had happened, but it was on cross-examination,
right, when her credibility was being challenged.
And she mentioned, she said trauma once
She said, I'm still going over the trauma that was in my body
because
from the attack.
The defense attorney at the time was challenging her recollection of the events.
But
you're right, Justice.
Isn't that just different? I mean, you're talking about credibility instructions. I mean, let's just cut it to the core. If we look at Harada, a prosecutor is not permitted to express a personal opinion. Is that right? It's pretty black letter law, right?
And
if we're talking about context, and you're sitting there as the defense counsel, and they're talking about credibility instructions, and they're saying that the manner in which somebody testified is consistent with something.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a personal expression about the credibility or the truthfulness of a witness?
It's an opinion. It's an opinion that the prosecution is expressing to the jury that, you know, what you saw. It's almost, and I know the case is going back for
because
a new
trial. Okay, and let me just step back because it's not evidence, right? I mean, when you think about the context of this, we're talking about context. Isn't your position that it's really a comment on credibility of the witness by saying that's really something aside even from evidentiary provisions, you know?
It is an opinion about the credibility of the witness, but, and once again, I know I've said this before, it's coming at the wrong time right before the jury goes in to deliberate, and we just would argue that it's improper.
Well, it was being used to bolster the credibility of the complaining witness, wasn't it? It was trying to explain away the inconsistencies, because that was the entire cross. Just pointing out inconsistency after inconsistency or alleged inconsistency. Yes. Isn't that how it seemed to have been used in that context in the closing argument?
What was used?
That traumatized to explain away the inconsistencies in her testimony. She was shaking, she was crying, she was doing all these things, and it was to indirectly bolster her credibility.
Yes.
By saying that was a result of being traumatized.
Yes.
Which you're equating as a medical diagnosis.
Yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Which is, well, I mean, it's in the DSM. I was checking.
That's what you started with.
Yeah, yeah.
Correct.
Yes, yes, yes.
Thank you.
Can I just ask one last thing before?
Yes, sir.
We hear from Mr. Tsushima. You argued there's no overwhelming evidence of guilt. And because, you know, you brought this appeal on this issue, my understanding is your position is that standing alone, this error would be grounds for a new trial, correct?
Yes.
Okay, so how do you assess the evidence of all the physical trauma, the photos of bruising on her face, tears in her labia, tears in other parts of her genitalia, petechiae, I can't pronounce it, on her breast, and then a DNA sample from her breast that can't exclude the defendant, except, you know, you'd have to go through 1.1 million other people before you'd find somebody with that sample. How do you, that you characterize that as not overwhelming?
Justice, I didn't handle the trial, and I know this case is going back for a retrial, but I'm not so sure that was the...
I mean, you made the argument, so there's no overwhelming evidence of guilt. So I'm just asking you, how do you account for the fact that there was multiple instances of trauma, which the nurse said are consistent with sexual assault, including a tear in her labia and another tear in her genitalia and bruising on her breast. I don't know. I'm not sure what that word means, but petechia, whatever that is. And then 1.1 million on the DNA sample. That's not arguably overwhelming evidence.
Yes.
Just ask. You made the argument. I want to be sure I understand your position.
At this point, this is where I would tap and say, you know, that might not have been the best argument to make as far as throwing the kitchen sink into the appeal.
Okay, very well.
Yes.
We'll hear from Mr. Tsushima.
Thank you. Thank you, Jeff.
For the record, and may it please the court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima, on behalf of the state of Hawaii, and I work for Stephen Ulm.
Could you lower your microphone a little?
Yeah, and I work for Stephen Ulm. Sorry, I just want to keep it a little light. I appreciate what this court has already discussed in the first half of this argument, because it really touches upon what I wanted to discuss when I presented my argument here, because I really don't want to regurgitate what's already in the filed submissions or what's been discussed by the ICA, except to this one remark by Judge Leonard, who did find that this argument in particular was still prosecutorial misconduct. And what Judge Leonard wrote was that there is no evidence about post-abuse trauma. Of course, I disagree with that, but it's the second part I want to talk about. And it's where Judge Leonard says, or how traumatized persons act or testify in court. And I think that's what we've been talking about this morning. And I just wanted to give my honest opinion when I first saw, first read Harada and first read the prosecutor's argument as stated in Harada, which I appreciate this court wrote in full, wrote the five paragraphs that preceded the argument in question that the court had a concern with. And when I read that argument, I actually thought, you mean we can't make that argument? And I thought, isn't that common sense? Because when I looked at that argument, and I know we've had the discussion about what does consistent with someone who's been traumatized means. And when I saw the prosecutor's argument and what I took away from it and what I gathered the prosecutor was getting at was just calling to the jurors their own personal experience, their own common sense, their own common experiences. And that's why when when I read the argument, and I know there's a discussion about no evidence in the record and how can the prosecutor make this argument, but my takeaway from that was the prosecutor was asking the jurors to use their own common sense. So when the prosecutors...
But what common sense do people really have in terms of how people testify on the stand and how emotional they get on the stand? Because that was what was at issue in Hirata and here. The fact that people got emotional. And the prosecutor says, that is consistent with someone who's been traumatized. Is that really a common sense thing? I mean, how many lay people have actually observed victims of sexual assault testifying on the stand? And as indicated, it doesn't appear there's really any consistency in the way people testify, whether they're emotional or not. And so when a prosecutor says this manner of testifying is consistent with someone who's been traumatized, that seems to be quite different from saying this is someone who has been traumatized.
Right.
Consistent with is expert speak. It's saying this is how, this is bringing in additional evidence that was not at trial. In other words, this is how people who have been subjected to sexual assault or some traumatic incident, this is how they testify. This is what I've observed. This is what I see. This is consistent with it. And, you know, I am not going as far as saying you, a prosecutor cannot say someone was traumatized, but it's the way that it's presented. This is consistent. The manner of testifying is consistent with someone who's been traumatized. I do have a concern with that. And I'm wondering how, whatever you think about Hirata and whether you thought that it was common sense or not, how can you distinguish Hirata in this case?
Okay, I appreciate the point you made, and I did pick up on the point you made on the front half about pointing out that actually the opposite is also true. But that's the thing with a case and an issue like this, is because I do appreciate my lawyer's friend's opinions, and I bounce it off them. And
sorry, I'm having a hard time understanding
you.
Yeah, I don't know, Kurt, if you can
maybe
work on the sound volume.
I feel like it's going up and down at times.
Yeah, I think if you step back a little bit, that's what's happening. Kurt, any...
Okay,
so just try to find a good spot and stay there.
Okay, I'll try.
Try to find that spot, a sweet spot, and just about 6 inches away, I think, is what's doing it.
So I do appreciate the comments by my lawyer friends and, of course, my prosecutor friends when about issues off of them. And I do appreciate their input on a case like this, where the concern and a valid concern by this court is how can an argument like this affect the jurors? That's when I really value the opinions of my non-lawyer friends, my non-lawyer family, and anybody who listened to it. And I want to get their opinion. So I put this argument before them and I say, if you heard this argument, what's your takeaway from it? And I don't know if this court has done it already with the non-lawyer friends, you know, or family members, but I think what I suggest you're going to get from them is this: so what? And then you might have to ask them something more. You might have to say, well, what's your takeaway from that? What has the prosecutor told you? And I submit what you're going to hear from them is this: you're going to say, that's common sense. They're telling me it's consistent with a person who's been traumatized. So that crying is consistent with having gone through something that's emotional, that's something that's stuck with you.
All right. So then a prosecutor could also say that an unemotional person is consistent with someone who's been traumatized.
I think that would be different, because that wouldn't be, because now you're entering the area where, from your experience, because you've been experienced with it, you know that, or an expert or a veteran.
But we're not talking about how people act right after an incident, which is what lay people are talking about, or how they might, you know, talk about it with friends. We're talking about how people testify on the stand.
Right.
And when a prosecutor says the way in which this person testified is consistent with someone who's been testified, it's bringing in all the other cases that this prosecutor has allegedly scene and how victims allegedly testify while they're on the stand. When there's no testimony saying this is how victims testify on the stand. When victims of sex assault testify on the stand, they tend to break down and they get emotional, right? I mean, there's no such testimony. So when the prosecutor says this, the prosecutor is not bringing in common sense, common experiences, because sex assault victims testifying on the stand is not a common day-to-day experience for lay people. They're not watching sex assault victims testify in court. That's not a common experience.
Right, and that's where I disagree that it's the prosecutor relying upon an expert position or her experienced knowledge of how a victim testifies. What the argument is saying is for the jurors to draw from their common experience, their personal experience. And what I mean by this, Justice McKenna, is that we've all had experience in trauma, in experienced trauma events, traumatic events. And if we're lucky enough not to have, we have friends or family who have experienced that. And if we're still lucky enough to have a life where nobody we know has ever experienced trauma, we've never seen them cry while talking about something that was traumatic to them, that we've seen it on TV. We've seen people talk about the Maui fires, having been caught in the middle of it and crying months later after the event. 9/11, having been caught in the fires, talking about it months or years after the event. And we've seen that people react to traumatic events and that they can get emotional about it.
And Mr. Shima, I mean, I guess what Justice McKenna just pointed out is it's maybe, maybe not. And if a juror thinks, like your family members or whoever, that the common understanding of how a sexual assault victim testifies is emotionally, but that's not really accurate because it might not be, then isn't it even more dangerous when a prosecutor says that's consistent with somebody who's been traumatized? I mean, it seems like it makes it worse if the common understanding is inaccurate.
No, because common is just consistent with. It means it's not in opposition to, that it's compatible with, or that it's agreeing with. That's literally what that means. And when the juror hears that, a lay person hears that, what their response to that is, no kidding. Tell me something I don't know. That when somebody's talking about something emotional, that they get emotional.
But isn't the prosecutor, though, just reaffirming what might be an inaccurate understanding, and it coming from the prosecutor? Doesn't that, it seems like that somehow undercuts the right to a fair trial if the prosecutor is somehow propping up a common misunderstanding.
Well, that's the part I wanted to get to, because ultimately it is whether this argument undercuts the defendant's right to a fair trial. And when we're looking at that argument, when you're saying, well, the person cried, it's consistent with being traumatized. Well, then the example I'd like to bring up is is a very famous case, was the Amber Heard versus Johnny Depp case. And the reason I wanted to bring that up
is, sorry, I really cannot hear you.
Oh, sorry, do I need to slow down or? The case I wanted to bring up was a very famous case, the Amber Heard versus Johnny Depp case. And maybe, I hope, you know, you may have seen it. I don't mean to stomp on Ms. Heard when I say this, but she did get emotional on the stand, and that was consistent with the allegations of abuse that she was making. Now, I know that was a civil case.
Well, so, you know, let me ask you, could a defense attorney then, let's say that alleged sex assault victim was completely unemotional in describing everything.
Yes.
Could the defense attorney say, then argue, you saw how she testified. She was completely unemotional. And this is inconsistent with someone who's been traumatized.
That was going to be my point. I believe they could. And I believe they have, in our past cases, pointed that out when it's happened. I don't know if you had it in the cases you saw, but I've heard those kind of arguments made.
Do you object? Does the state object?
No, I don't believe so, because I believe that's fair game. When you're commenting on whether that emotion can the jury can use that to weigh on their determination of credibility when it comes to demeanor and you know, the appearance of the witness at trial. Anyway, I want to get back to my point about the Amber Heard
counsel
case.
Can I just ask you this on just to follow up on that? How is someone psychologically affected as a result of being traumatized?
Sorry, what was that again?
How is someone psychologically affected as a result of being traumatized? Because you folks point in your filings, you refer to a lasting psychic effect. That's a definition that you folks alluded to. So how is someone psychologically affected as a result of being, quote, traumatized?
I think it's just the common understanding and the common experience of a person that when they go
what is it though? What's the psychological effects? Because you said, you're saying it's a lasting psychic effect. That, to me, starts getting into the medical realm.
I don't think it does. I think it comes from the personal experience.
PTSD is a diagnosis, is part of the DSM. It's on the DSM-5. Isn't that, it's a formal diagnosis when we're talking about trauma, traumatized.
Right. And I believe the formal diagnosis is actually post-traumatic stress disorder. And that was never discussed. And obviously that there was no,
well, when they said someone was traumatized, are they talking about PTSD? Are they talking about something else? What is it that they're talking about?
They're just talking about the common experience of having gone through something shocking or disturbing or emotional that affects you, that when you discuss it, you may get emotional. And so I want to, if I can.
But going back to my original question.
Yeah.
How is someone psychologically affected as a result of being traumatized?
In the common understanding that we have, that when we talk to
what is it?
That when somebody talks about something that is traumatizing to them, and that differs from person to person, obviously.
Right. Does it? And that's the point. Does it matter what type of trauma it is? The duration of the trauma? Does it matter if someone has predisposition to not being able to cope with emotions as better than someone else? Does it matter on all those different factors?
It doesn't matter, because from our common experience, it varies. It does vary on how someone can be affected. Some people can be non-affected by the most traumatizing event and they don't get emotional by it. But it also is consistent with, meaning it's not contrary to, when you talk about something that's emotional, that's affected you, that you cry. And I think that's where it's just been much ado about nothing.
Why not just call a medical expert, psychologist, psychiatrist, and lay the foundation that would end the problem here?
Because I don't think it requires that. The point that I was making this morning is that when we're making comments that don't require, and I would submit this, it doesn't require an expert testimony to point out something that you're just asking the jurors pull from your own reason and common sense or your own common experience, nothing more.
It assumes that traumatized is not a medical diagnosis of some sort, right?
That assumes that. Yes, because my argument would be that while a lot of the psychological terms like traumatized, schizophrenic, paranoid, what, like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, you might only hear those terms as a psychiatric diagnosis. But nowadays, it's in the common language where someone might say, I just walked past the bus stop and I saw a guy looking left and right like he was paranoid. We use that in common language.
Right, but the definition you folks cited to, you're saying trauma is defined, often producing a lasting psychic effect. I mean, to me, that gets into medical expert testimony.
I disagree because we're not referring to...
What's a psychic effect?
Just a mental effect.
What does that mean?
That it affects you mentally. That when
crying. In what way?
Crying.
How is it exhibited? How is it exhibited? How do people exhibit?
Through crying, through emotions, through shaking of voice, through the type of behavior that happened in this case that the prosecutor pointed out.
Mr. Tsushima, there's so many different reactions to trauma, right?
I
mean, some people totally block it out of their mind and they don't even remember what happened. So this is a medical thing. And that's why saying this is consistent with someone who's been traumatized is the prosecutor stating an expert opinion.
I have to disagree.
Or bringing in additional, what the prosecutor is basically saying is, I've seen a lot of these cases and this is consistent the way she testified is consistent with how victims of sex assault testify. And that wasn't in evidence. It's arguing something that's not in evidence.
If the prosecutor had said that in this case, I would not be arguing against
that. If she had said she had, you know, I wouldn't be feeling this strongly if she had just said she, you know, this person was traumatized, because that's kind of vague. I mean, candidly, I've testified in court. Testifying in court is traumatizing. So even without being a victim of a physical or a sexual assault.
I agree with you 100%. And that's my argument. I do not see it as different from making that argument, because consistent with, I understand your position on that connotes an expert type position. I disagree. I think all it's saying is that it's not.
Could a prosecutor say the way this person testified is consistent with someone with histrionic personality disorder?
No, I think that's different, because then I think you are hinting at a more specific psychiatric diagnosis, and that goes to what I was saying to Justice Devens. Those type of terms still aren't used in the common language, but something as simple as traumatized, as even paranoid, is used in the common language nowadays and doesn't connote
you're saying
psychiatric
that
diagnosis.
The prosecutor could say this is someone, the way this is consistent with someone who is paranoid, that would be okay.
With the looking, like if there's a evidence that someone, say a witness or some person who's involved in the case, like I said, was looking back and forth at a bus stop, and that's consistent with somebody being paranoid. Yes, I would submit that is just asking the jurors to draw from their common experience. Do you believe
earlier also referred to the phrase schizophrenic. Are you suggesting that a prosecutor could say someone is schizophrenic without expert evidence?
I would in the context, like it said here. Just
all right. So you're saying that if this person was saying that they heard voices or something, the prosecutor, without expert evidence, could say this is consistent with someone who's schizophrenic.
I believe so. I believe that's something that a juror could draw from their own experience. But back to your point, because you do make a very good point about the witness had the witness not shown any emotion, had just been deadpan, no emotion when talked about the sex assault. That's true, that is also consistent with someone who's been sexually assaulted or who's been traumatized.
And so the prosecutor could say that.
No, I disagree, because that, I believe, is not within the common knowledge of the juror.
Whose common knowledge are you talking about? My friends who confess sexual assaults to me were very calm when they told me months later. So whose common knowledge are you talking about?
I'm talking about everybody. Those are people who have specific knowledge. You have specific knowledge from sitting on the bench and having heard.
No, I'm talking about people, common knowledge. You're saying that it's common knowledge that months later, when a woman describes a sex assault, they're going to be emotional about it. I disagree. Where does this common knowledge come from? That's not my life experience.
That people who go through traumatizing experiences, that it's consistent with, meaning not contrary to, having gone through that experience, getting emotional about talking about something emotional is not inconsistent behavior.
And being very calm is not inconsistent either.
When someone knows that that's the type of behavior that is consistent with that type of trauma, and that is not within the common knowledge.
In other words, there's really no understanding of what is consistent, whether sex assault victims are emotional or not. There is no common knowledge. So how can this be a common sense thing then?
It's a common sense thing when you look at it for what the argument is saying. It's saying that she got emotional in front of the jury. It's saying that she got emotional when talking about a traumatic emotional experience. And that's something that is within the common knowledge of your average person. I want to bring in my example, if I may, about Amber.
I'm sorry, I need to ask you context. Okay, we're talking about one word here quite a bit, an important word, traumatized, that was used. The context of this case, though, the larger context was The closing argument from the defense was she lied. I mean, that over and over, right? They called into question the complaining witness's testimony as being fabricated. So in that context, how does this play? I mean, does that matter?
It doesn't, because what my point is with this argument is that it does draw to, it really isn't a persuasive argument by the prosecutor. I mean, those no disrespect to the prosecutor when I say that, but when you put it in its context, where the prosecutor is saying, you saw the victim got emotional, and that is consistent with somebody who's been traumatized. If I can go to my example just for a second, with the Amber Heard case, because in that case, I'm not taking an opinion on it, but what was widely viewed was that Ms. Amber, while it was consistent with someone who had been abused, they did not believe that her crying was legitimate. They believed she was acting. That's just a common, just a majority type of view of it. And I don't mean to stomp on her by saying this. And I realize that's a civil case, but what I'd like to do is take Ms. Heard out of that case and put her in this case, and now make the same argument that the prosecutor made, that Ms. Heard testified, you saw her cry, and she testified consistent with someone who's been abused. How affected is that argument? What difference would it have made on the defendant's right to a fair trial? Because what we all know, what mattered in that case was that moment. And that's the moment that the jury decides, do they believe that that person is actually crying because they are affected by the trauma that they went? Or is it something else? Are they lying?
Can I switch to a different area? You know, if I look at closing arguments from prosecution and defense, I mean, free-flowing syntax and flair, you know, they add something to a closing argument. But, you know, this one really wasn't improvisational. It really wasn't sort of an audible. It was right out of the playbook that was used before. And I'm just wondering, how is the same play constitutionally out of bounds on one play, but then the next play, the exact same thing, is constitutionally sound? I mean, are you just really asking us to overturn Harada?
I am imploring this court to reconsider its position on the matter. And that's really all I had to cover this, unless this court does have further questions.
How is the approach in prosecuting a child sex abuse case different or the same as the prosecution of the sexual assault of an adult?
In that case, there was a, and generally speaking, I think you mean generally speaking, there is usually an expert psychologist called to testify to speak of the dynamics of, usually what's talked about is like rape, late reporting or tunnel memory of the minor. And that's usually a big difference between the minor case and an adult case, because in an adult case, we don't call a Dr. Bivens type of person to discuss the dynamics. And I think it goes to my point, because when it comes to the testimony of the victim, what we're asking the jurors to draw from is not expert testimony, is not an expert opinion, is not expert experience, but from their own common experience, from their own experience that they've gone through their lives. When we discuss any inconsistencies that may occur while the person is testifying, not unlike any other case that we might deal with.
So that's an argument that the two cases could be reconciled. Harada speaks to what's an appropriate argument in the case of a child, where there's an inference or something special or unique that the prosecutor knows about children sex assault victims, versus an adult where it's common sense and knowledge that how people act when they've been subject to something that's
traumatic. Yes, absolutely, Chief Justice.
May I ask one last one?
Yes, of course.
And I bring this up only because Mr. Rodby had mentioned it, but that Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders PTSD is what I understand part of the diagnosis or one of the diagnoses in that book, which I understand is the Bible for psychologists and psychiatrists and so on. And under PTSD, one of the criteria is exposure to sexual violence. Is that part of your common knowledge that that's part of the criteria for PTSD?
No, I'm not saying that that's part of the common knowledge.
No, I'm just asking you.
Okay, sorry. No, that wasn't what I was suggesting.
You were not aware of that?
No, I wasn't suggesting that.
I know. Were you aware of it is my question?
Yes, I am.
You were?
Yes, I was. Yes.
Thank you.
So your view would be, could a prosecutor step up and say, this is consistent with someone who has PTSD if there's no evidence about psychiatric evidence or psychological evidence?
No, I think that would go against what I've been saying this morning, because I think when you get to specific diagnoses like PTSD, that has in the DSM certain criteria, as Devins had pointed out, then there is a difference that isn't within the common knowledge.
You just told me that you thought a prosecutor could say that the person testifying was testifying consistent with someone who was schizophrenic without expert testimony.
I did say that.
Yeah. So there's difference between schizophrenic is common knowledge, but PTSD is not.
And I did. I'm sorry if I meant if it, I implied that schizophrenia, the diagnosis and the criteria that matches it with is within the common knowledge. That's not what I meant. What I meant was that term is used in the common vernacular of people every day. And that's why when used in that common vernacular sense, I would think it's permissible. But
So to make it clear, you are asking us to overrule Hirata. I'm assuming that since the Hirata case came out, prosecutors have not been arguing the way this person testified is consistent with a victim, someone who's been traumatized. But now we want to be able to go back to that form of argument. Want that to be allowed again.
Absolutely. I wouldn't be able to know what the prosecutors have been arguing in their trials since then. But I would assume that they wouldn't be using that type of language.
Very well. Thank you for your argument. Now we'll hear Justice. Mr. Rodby's rebuttal.
Frankly speaking, I'm not sure I have anything else to say, but I believe there should be a bright line rule prohibiting this type of vouching, especially in terms of, I believe, and if you were to look in the DSM, there's trauma, and then one of the subsets of trauma is post-traumatic stress. Trauma. But so what we're asking is that you issue a bright line rule. Mr. Browder knows what's going on here today. He's incarcerated at Segaro. He knows that he's going to be going back for another trial in Kona. And he wanted me to let you know that he just hopes this time around he's given a fair trial. So
if we rule in your favor on the issue, do we even need to address whether or not it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt?
You know, I was afraid somebody would mention the harmless error because I have a...
Because the state did not actually file a cert app from
right.
the new trial
yes.
order for the other alleged other misconduct found by...
And I'm not sure today is the right day, but frankly speaking, I think that when a court looks at prosecutorial misconduct and tries to analyze it under the three factors... I think that that's wrong, that prosecutorial misconduct should result in a new trial. Whether or not there was an objection, whether or not there was a curative instruction, whether or not the weight of the evidence. Because if you think about it, say, for example, the prosecutor has a case that's a slam dunk, right? If one of the elements of whether or not an error is harmless depends upon the strength of the evidence, then it's almost as if the prosecutor has a slam dunk, he or she could be unleashed. Because, why? Because the evidence was so strong. So I don't know what the remedy is, but I just think that if there's prosecutorial misconduct, there should be a new trial, that there shouldn't be the three factors.
Well, it seems like you're advocating a new standard, but
yes,
in this particular case, though, the prosecutor did not challenge the finding by the ICA that there was a reasonable possibility that one juror would come to a different outcome?
Yes, yes.
But that was not a different statement, right?
Yes.
We're not talking about the statement that's before us. Okay.
Yeah. And frankly speaking, I was worried about that. It's like, what kind of can of worms did I open by, you know, filing for a writ?
And just so we're clear on the statement that's before us, the traumatized statement, we're doing a plain error review. There was no objection at trial, right? Okay. And that's the only issue, at least that you have brought before this court.
Yes, Justice Gonzalez. Yes.
Well, anything further for the court?
Thank you, CJ.
All right. Nope. Thank you to both our attorneys for your arguments today. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Please rise.
Ua ho'o mololo ia mai ne kea aha ho'o kolokolo ki'i ke hana hana. This Honorable Supreme Court is now recessed.